coming up. We're talking Cavs, Pistons. How the hell did Detroit blow that lead? Tom Haverstraw joins the show to discuss that. Wemby's impact, elevating his play even further in the playoffs. Just crazy to witness whether Minnesota has any chance at all. Then we get a little bit into the NBA draft as well, how excited we are for the Western and Eastern Conference Finals as well. That's all coming up right now with me and Tom Haverstraw. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Before we get started, wanted to let you know that Yahoo's all-new 2026 Soccer Pick'em is here just in time for the world's biggest soccer tournament. So please be sure to join at yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em. To talk about the NBA playoffs, it's Tom Haverstraw. Tom, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Kev. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent, man. We got a two game sixes on Friday night. No games tonight on Thursday. A night off. First one since, I think, the play-in tournament way back in the middle of April. But last night, Cavaliers won an epic overtime. Game five, 117-113. Now they're up 3-2 over the Detroit Pistons. And this game turned when the Pistons were up 9 points. And then Strus picked up Cade Cunningham, full court, 94 feet. And from there, everything changed for the entire Pistons offense. They were denying the ball to Cade Cunningham, throwing two at him every single time he touched the ball, Tom. And the last 3 minutes of regulation, the first 2 minutes of overtime in this stretch, Cade touched the ball 8 times. They doubled him or threw two guys towards him every single time he touched it. It was a 13-0 Cavaliers run to tie the game in regulation, to take a big lead in overtime. And I couldn't believe it took so long to do it for Kenny Atkinson to decide to do this. But once they did, it just showed how little options the Pistons have aside from Cade. And when you play anybody but Cade defense, I think we saw what happens with the end of this game between Cleveland and Detroit.
Kev, we talked about this in the last series. It was Orlando. How they get back in this series is to double Cade Cunningham. And it's so hard for the Pistons to come up with any good offense without Cade Cunningham doing it all for them. So that's the thing, is like Tobias Harris has been playing out of his mind up until this point. But if his shots aren't falling and he's not able to get to his spots, then this is what it looks like. And so this is why the Pistons and the Cavs are in such a precarious position, because I don't know which Pistons team we're going to get from the supporting cast. And if they're not all firing on, when they're not firing on all cylinders, this Pistons team is very one-dimensional. It's just Cade and everything else. And so for the Cavs and this series, it just feels like one little lever that they pull or one button that they push, this game completely changes and the series completely changes. And so that's why this is the most like Jekyll and Hyde series I've seen in a long time. It's hard to get a grip on these teams because a lot of the character issues or the soft play from the Cavs, it can be completely undone. And suddenly you're like, wait, this is the vision. Mobley's playing two-way basketball. Harden's scoring. He's distributing the rock. He's getting blocks. And then you see Donovan Mitchell carrying the team for long stretches. That's the vision. And on the other side, it's like, wait, who's the second scorer that they're going to be able to depend on the Pistons? It's just so unpredictable in this series, which is why in game six, I don't know what we're going to see. But if they continue to double Cade Cunningham, man, this could be over quickly for the Pistons.
I mean, look, 8 touches over a 5-minute stretch. He touched the ball for 40 total seconds over 5 minutes. That's just hard to fathom, but it's understandable in some regards because, like I said, they are pressuring him full court. They are doubling every single time he touched the ball. They're basically playing zone behind the doubles. They're like, okay, yeah, we'll live with a Tobias Harris three. We'll live with a Caris LeVert isolation at the end of the clock. Please give us a Caris LeVert iso. We'll live with Paul Reed running out the clock, 24-second violation. And it worked. But I at the same time, I just can't believe just how discombobulated the entire Pistons offense look, Tom, I mean, we've seen this with J.B. Bickerstaff when he was in Cleveland with a lack of backup options when your first option doesn't work. And this happened again in this game five between Detroit and Cleveland. And a part of me wonders if Kenny Atkinson was just sitting on this in part, this curveball, to throw it late in a game for when it was needed rather than using it early and giving Detroit time to come up with another plan to have a backup option, because they just looked like they had no answers in this situation. And I think you mentioned like the second option aspect, Tom. Well, I mean, first of all, before that, you mentioned Evan Mobley. Evan Mobley was awesome in this entire 5 minute stretch. He had a really great game overall. He had that lefty dunk, the three-pointer, the block on Paul Reed, and then contained him after Reed grabbed the rebound. Mobley was awesome. Harden and Mitchell made enough plays. Struess, the role player, stepped up. They just feel like they have a lot more options. Jared Allen had the putback as well. I said after game two just how I felt like the Cleveland Stars were just folding. They weren't good enough. They've been great in the three games since, whereas the Detroit side, I mean, Cade has had some really sloppy turnovers. On my Tuesday episode, I said casual Cade is here. He's back. It looks like the guy from the Orlando series when he had 24 turnovers over a three-game stretch. But more than anything else, Tom, I can't blame Cade entirely when he is literally the only source of offense and creation and secondary scoring, because Tobias Harris is back to looking like Sixers Tobias Harris. You know, the magic's gone. That's the seven game straight of 20 points is over at this point. And then you got like Caris LeVert can't do anything. Duncan Robinson's out. The guy you traded for at the deadline, Kevin Herter, played 3 minutes. He's doing nada out there. And then Jalen Duren, his powers are all gone. They're just done. He didn't play the whole last 17 minutes of the game. Paul Reed didn't play at all until the fourth quarter, and then he played the last 17 minutes. It just blows my mind.
Have you ever seen that before?
No, never.
What was that? Like, to be so riding, like ride or die with Jalen Duren, and that not playing Paul Reed at all, and then go with him for the final 17 minutes of the game, is, I've never seen that in the playoffs. And it's happened when it comes to like blowouts. We've seen that with blowouts where a coach will be like, all right, send him in. We're taking our starters off the floor and we'll have our backups finish the fourth quarter here. This was a competitive game. They went into overtime. They still were like, yeah, let's get the guy. Let's dust him off that we haven't played him the entire game and have him finish. And it was apparent when you watch Paul Reed, B-ball Paul was so much more energetic. He had much more lift. He was bouncing around the floor in the very way that he does and just gave them an extra bounce that Jalen Duren, man, I feel so dumb for having him second team all NBA this season after what he's shown in the postseason. It's one of the big like facepalm moments of the season for me, because it looks like he has anvil for shoes. Like he looks like he has anvils, and he's not strong anymore somehow. He looks too heavy. You know, it reminds me of when Roy Hibbert in an offseason was like, I'm gonna get in the weight room and like put on 30 pounds. And everyone I talked to around the league was like, bad idea. We don't need him to be slower out there and more grounded. That's what it feels like with Jalen Duren, is just like all the weight that he has on him somehow has kept up with him or caught up with him. And I pulled up these stats because for J.B. Bickerstaff to just be like, I'm out on the Jalen Duren thing. We got to bring in somebody else. And I'm not going back. As things are unraveling in the fourth quarter down the stretch, I'm still not going with Jalen Duren. Says so much about the confidence that he has with him. This playoffs, no player has seen a scoring average drop by more than Jalen Duren. He went 19.5 in the regular season to 10.1 here in the postseason. 9.4 point drop. Second place is Jalen Tyson with the Cavs, obviously. Down 8 points. Harrison Barnes down 7 points. Isaiah Stewart's down 5.5 points since his regular season. But the thing that jumps out to me is that in this series, in the conference semis, Kev, there are 74 players with at least one second chance point, meaning an offensive rebound in that second possession that they've scored. Julius Randle has 26. Chet Holmgren has 23. Rudy Gobert has 22. Wemby has 14. Jared Allen has 19 second chance points in this series, like in the conference semifinals. 74 players have at least one. Jalen Duren has zero.
How is that even possible? How is that possible?
Jalen Duren had the fourth most second chance points in the regular season. He had 302. And in this entire series, Kevin, he has not scored on second chance opportunities. He just has no lift, no touch around the basket. He's getting blocked by James Harden. And it's just, what happened to this guy?
How does that, I it's just not even computing in my brain. I've watched every second of this series and I'm like, no,
he hasn't
what?
Scored a second chance point in five games. And he's one of the best in the NBA at this. So
crazy.
I mean, how, I don't know how you can explain it other than he just was not building conditioning wise for the 80, he was just eyeing the 82 game season, getting on all NBA so that he can get his big payday. And then just was completely gassed, or he's just, and it pains me to say this, he's just kind of like a DeAndre Ayton, where he has a lot of great box score numbers in the regular season, but when it comes to the postseason, it's a totally different game. And it's too early to say that he's the next DeAndre Ayton, but man, it feels like it in this postseason.
I think it's very possible he is, Tom. I do, because with Duren, like, I've had the similar, you know, highs and lows that I did over the years with DeAndre Ayton, where like you kind of ride the highs and you're feeling good, and then it dips down and you're like, I'm out on this guy. That's happened to me with Duren 100 times in his career. It's the way it's always been with him, up and down, up and down. And we're entering a major down now, and maybe he comes out on Friday night and he has 30 points and he dominates. You're like, Duren's back. Where was this guy? But I'm really doubtful. I think so much of it is they are. Cleveland's big, first of all. Jared Allen, Evan Mobley, they have guys at the wing like Dean Wade when he's out there. I don't think that's a total story, but I also think there's just a lack of skill, too. I think he's being scouted. I think when you watch, sometimes when he puts the ball on the floor, when he gets the ball at the elbow or he gets it out of the roll and he has to dribble once to the rim, they have guys in the paint, and like Harden a few times it's just boop, swiped at the ball. It's like they've really scouted his tendencies, where he likes to put the ball, what moves he's going to use. And then Allen, just simply Jared Allen and Evan Mobley are great defensive players as well. I think that's part of it too, but that doesn't explain your stat. 0 second chance points. I mean, what? You haven't grabbed a single offensive board and had one of your trademark putback dunks? How is that even possible? And the funny thing to me, Tom, about him not playing the final 17 minutes of the game, his best moment of the series happened a minute before he got subbed out, when he put Mobley underneath the rim. He backed him down and dunked over him. He just overpowered him. When that happened, it was one of my moments where I'm like, Evan Mobley's soft. You know, I'm sitting here watching the game like, Mobley's too weak. and then the whole rest of the game, Duren didn't play, and Mobley was incredible, just amazing down the stretch of that game. And it just, to me, Tom, like, it just feels like Cleveland has more depth at the top of their roster, more guys who can have moments at the top. It's like, for Detroit, it's Cade, and then that's it. For Cleveland, it's Mitchell, it's Harden, it's Mobley. Even Allen can have moments in series as well. And then they have more depth behind that as well. They have more quality role players. The fact Max Strus put the clamps on Cade Cunningham when he had that steal in the backcourt. I mean, come on, Cade. Like, you got to be so much less casual with the ball in your hands. And like I said, I'm not blaming Cade entirely. At 39 points in the game, he's the only guy who can do anything for Detroit, because Tobias Harris, it's over. The 20-point run is done. He's probably back to Sixers Tobias now. And there's literally nobody else on this team, because the Pistons front office decided to wait until the summer to make acquisitions, which, hey, maybe that works out. Maybe that will be for the best. Maybe this team wasn't going to win anything anyway. Maybe getting Michael Porter Jr. wouldn't have made a difference. Maybe overpaying for Lauri Markkanen or Trey Murphy or whoever wouldn't have mattered. And you get, and it works out this summer. Maybe that's the truth. But I feel like the Eastern Conference is so open this year, Tom, and that this is a missed opportunity to what would have been destroying the Magic if you had more options behind Cade. That would not have been a 7-game series. And then this series against Cleveland, I think there's a chance to be over if they just had another guy, if Tobias Harris was your third option instead of your second option, or you just had a better version of Tobias Harris, I think the series might be over at this point with the Detroit Pistons, because their defense is sensational. They're just missing that other guy.
Yeah.
I obviously there's still games to be played, but I still, if I'm a Pistons fan, Tom, I'm watching these games and I'm like, how the hell did we stop at Kevin Huerter? Really? How'd we stop at Kevin Huerter?
Yeah, I totally hear that. And when you lose a 20-point score and Jalen Duren averaged 19.5 in the regular season and had some really strong moments there down the stretch without Cade, when you lose that guy and he gets the Monstars powers is taken from him, it's really hard for Cade. There's so many times he gets downhill and then hits a dead end, leaves his feet, and then passes to the other team. And so much of that, I think, is that teams are collapsing the paint and daring a team that has two non-shooters in Ausar Thompson and Jalen Duren. We're just going to pack the paint, and there's going to be nowhere for you to go. There's no oxygen for Cade Cunningham, no space, no daylight for him to operate and have those passing lanes, because they just shut him down. They're not guarding the perimeter. And the two top playoff risers in scoring this playoffs is Cade Cunningham and Tobias Harris. And so when you lose one of those, Tobias Harris turns into a pumpkin again. They just got no other second option if Jalen Duren doesn't step up. And I'm surprised I didn't hit this earlier, but maybe this is the best stat of them all. Joe Ingles has played 1 minute in this postseason, in this series.
Oh, boy.
And he has more second chance points than Jalen Duren in the conference semifinals. Joe Ingles has more second chance points in this conference semis than Jalen Duren. He's played 1 minute. So there you go. It's just insane.
I mean, look, I think you hit on in passing there, Tom, the Ausar Thompson, Jalen Duren aspect, how neither of them can shoot. We saw Beef Stew, Isaiah Stewart, hit 2 3-pointers in the first half of that game. And I was like, oh, Beef Stew's showing up. I think he might be hurt. Like the amount of minutes he's playing right now in this series, it's been 13, 15, 9, 7, and 11 minutes so far in the series. He got hurt towards the end of the regular season. I feel like he's not as impactful defensively. He's not getting as much elevation when he leaps to contest shots. Having him, I think, would have made a huge difference if he could play 20, 25 minutes in the series, because he would allow you to space from the five, and that would make Ausar Thompson less of a liability if he weren't the only non-shooter out there on the floor and there without him. But with that said, I do think J.B. Bickerstaff has to go to Paul Reed earlier in these games, but it's not perfect. I mean, they did blow a 9-0 lead in 90 seconds down the stretch of the game, and he was not the main reason why, but part of the reason why, because he's not a scorer and it's not a great decision maker. He's just an energy guy. He's an energy big. You want him as your backup. I think that needs to happen. But the Ausar Thompson thing is tough, because he is sensational defensively, but such a liability offensively. He's not a scorer. He's not a shooter. You're not worried about him. You're part of the reason you can double Cade is because Ausar's out there. And yet, Ausar Thompson nearly saved the game in the closing seconds when he trailed Donovan Mitchell, swiped at the ball, knocked it away. And then came the moment when him and Jared Allen were running for the ball. And the broadcast, you know, Tim Legler had said, that should be a foul. You know, I totally disagree, Tom. I think two guys are chasing a loose ball. They both have the path to get there. Thompson turned his ankle. I think that's what caused the foul. He also pushed Allen's arm down. In these moments, I have always been swallow your whistle. Like two guys fighting for a loose ball, just because somebody falls to the ground, it doesn't mean there's a foul. And so often in the NBA, part of the big problem with flopping, this is not a flopping instance, but one of the big problems with flopping is just falling leads referees to blow the whistle. In this case, yep. I think Ausar Thompson turned his ankle. Both guys are going for the ball, but there was not a trip. He didn't stick his leg out and trip Ausar Thompson. He just fell with two guys fighting for it. You don't blow the whistle just because a guy falls. And like, good on the referees for not calling that, in my opinion. It would have been a soft call. Leave that in the regular season. Play on. We're going to overtime. And I'm happy they did what they did at the end of the game. Do you agree
with
me?
Yeah, I'm with you. Tony Brothers said after the game, they'll have to see the last 2-minute report. Basically, like, I don't care. Just this isn't going to matter. He decided not to make the foul call. And I think it's right. There were two guys going for the ball. And I think the only reason why this is a talking point is because Thompson made such a good defensive play that some people will look at that and be like, you got to reward that guy for making an outrageously meticulous ball swipe to get that steal from Donovan Mitchell in a huge moment. And then to have that, the ball right there, and then get poked away and then collapses and falls to the ground in that collision with Jared Allen. I think people are like, man, it would have been nice to see him be able to get a shot off in that closing seconds, but I don't think that's a foul. And we've seen it in this postseason, guys that are grifting, trying to fall down to the ground. I mean, Joel Embiid is super famous for this, is that every time there's contact, he's going to the ground. I remember Chris Herring wrote this great piece for ESPN where he said that part of it, Joel Embiid, why he falls so much isn't just about getting the free throw, get free throws and get the calls. It's also this softer on his knees or on his bodies, on his feet, that instead of landing with all of that velocity and force into his feet, you're kind of having the other parts of the body shoulder that, no pun intended, but basically takes some of that force away from his feet and his ankles and his knees. But there's a line. And in today's NBA, I feel like whether it's Jalen Brunson, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, what have you, there's too much grifting and falling to try to get foul calls. And in this instance, I'm glad Tony Brothers swallowed his whistle, because too much of this is just like, did the guy fall? Okay, yeah, I'm going to give him a whistle. And secondly, on this related, it's maddening always for me is how if a guy takes a charge but does not fall to the ground, there's never been a charge call on that play. You have to fall to the ground in order to get a charge call. If you do not, it will be considered a block or a non-call. And it is rewarded. Falling is rewarded in the NBA by officiating. It's really difficult. Officiating is difficult. But in this instance, I think this is the exception to the rule. I am glad they did not call a foul here. And with Ausar Thompson, great defensive play. But I don't think it should be rewarded with a foul call there.
Look, I mean, that's not why, for Pistons fans who aren't happy, that's not why you lost the game. You blew a 9-0 lead in 90 seconds in the final 3 minutes. You let the opponent go on a 13-0 run between end of regulation and overtime. That run extended to 18-2. 18-2 was the run at one point in end of regulation into overtime. And you had no backup options. That's why the game was lost. That's why the Pistons, as a one seed, trail 3-2 entering what should be a really exciting game 6. And we'll be right back after this break. Another game 6 as well between the Spurs and the Timberwolves. Spurs are up 3-2 in that series. And I don't feel good about Minnesota's chances of winning this game 6, even though it's home. As long as Victor Wembanyama is on the floor, Tom, like, good luck to you. Good luck to you. This series, the Spurs have a 95.3 defensive rating with Wemby on the floor, 106.9 with Wemby off the floor. The Wolves are taking 61% of their shots in the paint when Victor Wembanyama is not out there. That drops to 42%. With Wemby on the floor. You were just seeing players U-turn, say, never mind, I'm not testing the paint. Wolves turn into a three-point shooting team, a mid-range shooting team. They don't want to be that. They want to get into the paint, but Wemby does not allow that to happen. It happened all season long with the San Antonio Spurs. It played into why I voted him for MVP, why he was the unanimous defensive player of the year. But he has been even better in the playoffs. That's the thing that's so crazy to me, Tom, watching the Spurs. Victor Wembanyama has leveled his game up on both ends. It's crazy what we're witnessing right now.
This is the worst he's going to be. It's the worst he's going to be. Like, this is the beginning. That's what people don't realize is he's 22 years old. Already the unanimous defensive player of the year. And oh, by the way, Kev, he scored 27 points on the other end. And 2 games ago, he had 39 points on the offensive end. And he is dominating defensively in ways. I mean, think about it this way. He has blocked 8 different Minnesota Timberwolves in this series. And 1 out of 5 shots when he's on the floor, 1 out of 5 two-point shots are being blocked. 20% of the shots that you're taking inside the arc when he's on the floor are getting swatted away. That is an elite defense unto himself. That Victor Wembanyama is, guys are so terrified to go into the paint, like you said. And then when they do, whether he's crouching, he's playing crouching tiger and able to coax you into a shot and then he's going to swat it away, or you're just going to see him and you're not even going to try it, he is dissuading so many good shots into the paint, and he's neutralizing so many of these downhill attacks. Julius Randle, again, Julius Randle without a three-point shot in the postseason is so hard because there's no defensive value with Julius Randle. He's not a playmaker in the postseason like he is in the regular season. And Wemby just erases so much of what the opposing offense wants to do. And it's evident every time he's on the floor, you're just like, how do you score against the Spurs?
It's so funny when Kornet gets subbed into the game and the Wolves just, they turn into the Wolves, right? Yeah, exactly. They turn into the team that they want to be once Kornet's out there. But Wemby is, dude, I can't wait for Spurs Thunder. I'm just so excited for Spurs Thunder. It really can't come soon enough. I think it's going to be pure theater. There's just, from a pure basketball standpoint, this series alone is going to be great, but just the story aspect as well. It's either going to be Wemby's first loss, or it's going to be, oh my God, it's Wemby's league already. Yeah. That's what it's going to be. And it could be the Thunder going back to back. If they win the series and take down the Spurs, the start of that rivalry, there's just so many angles and so many possibilities. The fact the Spurs destroyed the Thunder during the regular season as well, like, it's just going to make it interesting. Does that matter at all? Maybe, maybe not. I'm just so excited. That's all. I'm just excited, Tom. I have no other words. I can't wait.
It's a young man's league, man. It's a young man's league. And that's what the San Antonio Spurs and OKC have figured out. They're way beyond everybody else on this whole thing, is that when you have Dylan Harper, Stephon Castle, Keldon Johnson, Victor Wembanyama running around and just swarming everybody, it's so hard to defend and so hard to actually account for how fresh those legs look. Like, it used to be that you couldn't play guys like Dylan Harper in the postseason. You couldn't. You couldn't rely on rookies in the postseason. And you're seeing with AJ Mitchell or with Stephon Castle or with last year Chet and all these other young players, J Dub, where it's like, oh, they're not like weaknesses. They're actually the strength of these championship contenders, is young legs running around everywhere, all that energy. And Dylan Harper doesn't look like he's too young for this. He looks like a vet out there. And I think it's the second gen thing. His dad, Ron Harper, played in the league a long time, and he's been he's part of the fabric of the NBA. It's in his blood, and understands what it takes in the postseason. We're at 20 years old. He can look like a steely veteran out there. And some of the plays, you're just like, how are these guys in their first postseason? And the reason is, well, Stephon Castle is playoff tested. He won two championships with UConn. He's been at these like high profile moments. And Victor Wembanyama in Europe has had a lot, and in Olympic play has had a lot of hugely big stakes games. And you're seeing these young legs, the youth, is the reason why these teams are able to assert themselves in the long season, and all that depth is showing itself in Dylan Harper. I mean, can we say enough things about how good Dylan Harper has been as a 20-year-old rookie?
Dylan Harper, I mean, look, midway through the season, I wrongly said, oh, I think the Spurs would probably take Konkanipal over Dylan Harper. Second half of the year, Dylan Harper just, boop, leveled up, started hitting threes. The at-rim finishing even got better. If you look at Dylan Harper first half of the year to the second half of the year, it was a big leap in his efficiency. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I think it was like around 50-ish percent, 52% in the first half of the year, closer to 60% in the second half. So he got better from three, got better at the rim, got better defensively. And then you watch him in the postseason, and the moment he had with that double behind the back move in the early offense into the dunk, I mean, oh my God, that play.
Dosunmu didn't even contest it. It happened so fast.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't even get a hand up. Harper just got zip line to the rim. And, like, look at Webby. Are you kidding me? It's nuts.
Dude, and he's a rookie. He's a rookie doing this. I mean, that's the funny thing is about, like, him, when him and Ace Bailey were playing on the same team in college with Harper, it's like, okay, there's no question this guy is going to be good, really good at getting to the basket. He's one of the best handlers and finishers we've seen in college basketball in the last decade plus. But for it to translate so quickly and for him to be even better now, the handle's even tighter. He's even more versatile with his finishing at the rim. He looks more explosive. Even like sometimes you see athletes improve their athleticism as they get older. I think all of those things have happened with Dylan Harper, and like, he's just a rookie. Castle's only in his second year. Wemby's still only 22 years old, and this team is already this good with these young guys that don't look like young guys at all. It's just really, really terrifying for the rest of the NBA to imagine what this is gonna look like in 5 years from now with whatever these guys could look like. They could have three all NBA guys on their team. I'm blown away.
Kev, we went 50 minutes in the pod yesterday, didn't say De'Aaron Fox once.
That's how scary it is.
It's just like, wait, we haven't had the De'Aaron Fox game yet. And we're at this point, they're up 3-2 in the series, game six on Friday. We haven't really had this takeover game from De'Aaron Fox. And so they have that in their back pocket, is the guy who makes, you know, $50 million a year for them that they acquired to be the star. They still have not hit their ceiling yet. If De'Aaron Fox hasn't risen yet, they also have the potential to get that at least for one game or two games against OKC. And the Dylan Harper play remind me so much. It's so weird. Like the quick lefty dunk there in the paint with all the flash and the handles. It reminded me, I know this is weird to say, but Manu Ginobili came to mind just because of the craftiness and just the speed to get downhill. And then suddenly he's flushing it through the rim. And just the whole lefty spur young guy, where there were moments in the early Spurs run with Ginobili where he would pull that out of thin air and you'd be like, what is that guy? And just, I know it's cliche to just point to Wemby as the next Duncan and Ginobili as the next, or Dylan Harper as the next Ginobili. But I really do feel like this is happening all over again, where the Spurs, it just feels like they have Hall of Famers left and right on this squad, and that they are at the start of a potential dynasty, which is why this OKC thing is so tantalizing, is that the NBA needs rivalries. The NBA absolutely needs these dominant dynastic teams going head to head like we have with LeBron and Steph, Magic and Bird. We have one right here. We're on the precipice. And the Minnesota Timberwolves can say all they want on Friday, but I think a lot of us secretly are hoping that for the biggest drama, the biggest stage in the NBA, we're going to get OKC.
Secretly? And Spurs. I want Spurs Thunder. I'll say it on the record.
There's a secret.
I'm rooting for the Spurs. No offense to Wolves fans. I'm rooting for the Spurs, and I want to see Spurs Thunder. I will not hide my feelings. That's what I am rooting for. See, you mentioned the importance of rivalries, Tom. It's a tradition in the NBA. Another tradition that I've been wondering about through this whole postseason, what happened to white jerseys at home? They're gone. Man. You don't see home teams wearing white jerseys. So far in this postseason, there's been 66 games played. In only 22 of them, the home team has worn white. 10 years ago, 86 games were played in the playoffs. How many of them do you think the home team wore white? 86 games.
All 86. I'm just going to say all 86.
It's not all 86. It's 83.
I mean,
83 games of 86 10 years ago in which the home team wore white. The only instances where it didn't happen were in round one, the Hornets against the Heat, the Pacers against the Raptors, and then the Spurs against the Grizzlies. They were their alternates. But 83 of 86, 10 years ago. And it was like that every single year of NBA history, basically, until recently, and especially this year, where only 22 times of 66 games, the home team has worn white. And I think this is a mistake by the NBA. I think it's a mistake by Nike. I think the tradition aspect matters. I think to be able to turn on the game and immediately know who's playing, you identify jerseys with teams. You can have all the fun you want during the regular season, even during the play-in and during the first round. Have all the fun you want. But from there on forward, I think the home team's going to be wearing white, except for some rare occasions. I like the Fiesta jerseys for game ones for the Spurs. That feels like a tradition. Every game one at home, the Fiesta jerseys. I think that's kind of a cool thing. But the fact that it's a third of the games, that was even lower than I thought, Tom, when I looked back at every game.
We used to be a country, Kevin. We used to have traditions. And here we are with two-thirds of the games have non-whites at home. This is crazy, man. Like, I applaud you for doing that research, because it needs to be said. We actually have to have some evidence here to back up what we're all feeling, is it just feels off. And bring back the pageantry. Bring back the tradition. Bring back the rivalries. We've got NBC back, and it's amazing to have Round Ball Rock. It's amazing to have Mike Tirico calling NBA games again. But we need to go not 75% of the way there. Continue bringing back the tradition. Adam Silver, bring back home white unis. It was weird last night watching it, and the blues for the Pistons and the whites for Cleveland. It just, these are intra-division rivals. We should not be doing this. We should be creating more of that old school feel of you know, connecting to old matchups of the past. The Cavs, I'd imagine, like, I'm trying to think right now of when LeBron went on that run against the Pistons. We should have connections to those games when LeBron had his breakout game against the Pistons. And that feels like a missed opportunity. So great job by you. That's 22 out of 66. Now that is a little number.
Yeah, that is a little number. We'll be right back. Some other news this week, Tom. Daryl Morey was officially fired on my Tuesday episode. Andrew Sharp and I talked about what's going to happen. It hadn't been announced yet. It has been announced that Daryl Morey got fired by the Philadelphia 76ers. I think this is a mistake by Philly. I think it's very odd that they're deciding to fire Morey, but they are deciding to keep Nick Nurse. I don't like when the GM is fired, but the coach is kept on. Then a new GM is supposed to be hired. Doesn't he want to have his own head coach? Just a bit strange to make that choice. And I just have a hard time saying, like, fire a dude who brought on VJ Edgecombe with a third pick, a non-obvious choice, who added Tyrese Maxey, who has drafted incredibly well. And even though some of the guys they lost, the Isaiah Joe types, the Julian Champagnes, these guys, they were on the team. I mean, like, if you're making good decisions, you have a lot of good players, and sometimes you lose those good players when you make a lot of smart decisions over time. And some of those choices were cap casualties as well, in part because of the ownership mandate to go underneath the luxury tax. That's in part why McCain was traded. I don't think Morey was especially as high on McCain as perhaps many Sixers fans, and I am personally, but, you know, getting the 22nd pick in this year's draft, which is historically strong, there's a lot of good options on the table for whoever's running Philly's front office with the 22nd pick this year to possibly get someone who could be as good as McCain or possibly even way better. I would not rule that out at all. So I think this was done for PR reasons by Josh Harris, the Sixers owner. Above all else, for PR reasons, I think there's an element of Bob Myers being in his ear as well. Two longtime rivals, the Warriors and Rockets. Maybe a little bit animosity there over the last decade as well. I think it was a mistake by Philadelphia. It's going to be hard to do better than Daryl Morey, in my opinion. What do you think, Tom?
I totally agree. They just beat the Celtics, and we got the Sam Hinkie gif out there like a week ago. And now Daryl Morey is being blamed for the roster construction that finally took down the East favorite Boston Celtics. Seems like an emotional decision by Josh Harris. Seems like he really likes Bob Myers, so much so he hired him to run the sports ops, if you want to call it, effectively for his pro franchises. And when they made that hire, I could not help myself but think of all those years of the battles between the Warriors and the Houston Rockets and the kind of the chatter between those two teams and the fight for the soul of the game and the way that James Harden and that team with Mike D'Antoni had kind of tried to take down the Golden State Warriors with all those three-pointers and the three-shot fouls, going small and trying to take down the Warriors in a way that no one had ever tested them to that extent. I remember Sloan conferences, Kev, where Bob Myers and Daryl Morey would be on the stage together arguing and having debates one-on-one, and it wouldn't get like unprofessional. It wasn't like it got testy where in the room you're like, ooh, these guys clearly don't like each other. There's a respect level. There's a professionalism. But it did feel weird to me. It honestly reminded me of, Kevin, when the the Colangelos were brought in to the organization of the Philadelphia 76ers, and Sam Hinkie was like, I'm out of here. Like, I see what's going on with Brian Colangelo. I'm out of here. I'm resigning. And here you see Daryl Morey in a similar situation. The irony here is that Sam Hinkie was the number two for Daryl Morey in Houston. And a similar thing happened here. The optics, I'm not saying this is exactly what happened, but the ownership brings in a Colangelo in the sense of Bob Myers to kind of undercut the existing power structure. And Daryl Morey, whether he was immediately feeling like he was on his last days, I'd imagine he felt a little undercut by that. And sure enough, beating the Boston Celtics as definitively as they did was not enough to save his job. And I think it's emotional, Kev, because I think that game four where the Knicks basically turned it into a home game, I felt like that maybe affected the human side of Josh Harris and that things had gotten so bad in a sweep that he felt like he had to have a head on a stake. And unfortunately for Daryl Morey, it was his head and not Nick Nurse in the figurative sense. Nick Nurse keeps his job, but someone had to pay. And it was Daryl Morey, and I think that was a mistake.
You can't fire the owner. It's just one of those cases. You can't fire the owner. You can't bring in a new owner who's willing to pay the tax to optimize a team around Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey and Paul George. And I think it's silly to blame Morey for the Paul George acquisition. That was the best and only option, a clear as day upgrade over Tobias Harris, who is one of the most hated people in Philadelphia sports history. And they hate a lot of people. Tobias Harris is right there near the top. Paul George was an upgrade. He can be blamed for re-signing Joel Embiid. That was in part done because he was 1 year removed from winning MVP. I mean, he had one injured year, but he's still 1 year removed from MVP. There's also the ownership incentive, the fact they're trying to get approval for a new stadium as well. Re-signing Embiid, having him long-term, plays a factor in that. I think it was a mistake. I look forward to seeing what they do. If they're going to look internally, maybe Elton Brand, who's been there a long time, even before Daryl Morey was there, and he's still there now. As far as I've heard, he has not been fired. He's still there. Will they go externally? Will Bob Myers bring in his own guy? I don't know. We'll find out. What I also look forward to is Daryl going to get another job? Because right now there's no openings. The openings have been filled already that were out there. And it's a short list historically of GMs that have run three or more teams. Rod Thorne did it, Brian Colangelo, Ernie Grunfeld, and they did it three times. And the four team GMs were Rick Sund, John Nash, and Pat Williams. So that's only six guys in NBA history that have run three or more teams. And Daryl would join that list as well after being in Houston, Philadelphia, and then potential third team. I'm not seeing anything out there right now, Tom. I don't know if anything's going to pop up necessarily either. So Daryl might have to wait a year. He's welcome to come on the pod at any time. He's welcome to join if he wants to.
I wonder, would Chicago have hired Daryl Morey if they knew he was available? And wouldn't that be quite a mountain for Daryl Morey to climb? He wasn't able to take down the Warriors. He wasn't able to get to the conference finals with Philly, but in terms of restoring the glory of the Chicago Bulls, I'd imagine the GM search becomes very different if Daryl Morey is available. And who knows if the ownership would actually pay out what it would take to bring in Daryl Morey, but that is something I was thinking about, is all the openings that we've had over the last couple of years and even in the last couple of weeks that have been so far filled, if that would have changed. And that's, I don't think that that's malicious by the 76ers. I think there's just poor timing on unfortunate timing for Daryl Morey, because right now there are no jobs right now. But we'll see. I mean, if you look around the league, a lot of the teams that you thought might have an opening, they just won the lottery or had an opportunity to get in the top four. And so I don't think they're going to shake up anything ahead of the draft. So this is was he perfect? No. I think there's a tendency for people to think that we're apologists for Daryl Morey because he's out here on social media. We've been to the Sloan Conference and he's, you know, Dork Elvis, as Bill Simmons calls him, and the head of Dorkapalooza at MIT Sloan Conference. And we're both New England guys. So this feels like that we are apologists for Daryl Morey. I would say I was really harsh about the McCain trade. I thought that was a huge mistake to move him. And I also think if you look at the books, they have $110 million allocated to Paul George and Joel Embiid next season. And the following season's $120 million on the cap for those two players. But that's not all Daryl Morey. If you look at when Joel Embiid signed, all over social media, the Sixers, it wasn't Daryl Morey sitting there with the contract. It was Josh Harris. Josh Harris with the statement. We're so glad to have Joel Embiid back. And what a representative of the community, a father, a guy who's such as iconic to the Philadelphia sports scene as anybody. It's great to have Joel Embiid back on a 3-year, $190 million extension. You can't go and say that was Daryl Morey's fault after that, when it was not fingerprints all over Morey on that Embiid thing, that the ownership wanted to have all the credit for locking him in long-term. And like you said, with maybe ulterior motives there, and then turn around and say, yeah, the cap is too crazy. That's Daryl Morey's fault.
Yeah. I'm definitely, like you said, I've been critical of Daryl plenty in the past as well. I wrote a feature story about him a few years back for The Ringer. I forget what year that was, maybe 2023, 2024, something along those lines. So I know him well. But I've been critical of him as well. I just think the winning speaks for itself, and the gutsy decisions over the years. And I think one of the reasons why maybe I am a Harden apologist and I am a Morey apologist is because I will always respect those Rockets teams for being one of the few teams to say, we will try to go toe-to-toe and we will try to take down these so-called juggernaut Warriors that are going to dominate for the next X amount of years. So maybe I am. For that reason, going back to the time in Houston. But I do think he deserves another gig. I just don't know what gig is going to be out there because there's a lot of good GMs running teams right now. I think you feel good about a lot of teams with the hands they're in with certain general managers, or the team is in a position where they're not at the point where you think about making a big change with front offices. So we'll see there. I think for the Philadelphia 76ers, it's going to be very fascinating to see what they do to replace him. If Bob Myers says, I'll take the gig, but I don't think he will. I think Bob Myers has more interest in ownership and something above GM moving forward. This week is the NBA Draft Combine, Tom. Adam Silver, there from Chicago, had an interview with Stephen A. Smith about the 3-2-1 lottery reform. Nothing really new with what was said there. I mean, from what I understand, the GM meeting happened, I think, on Monday. During the week of the combine, the in-person meeting in Chicago. Nothing was changed during that one. From what I understand, today is a big day. The NBA is going to meet with the competition committee in Chicago, and then some potential tweaks and changes will be discussed or possibly even implemented today, later, whenever that happens there in Chicago. But from Adam's interview with Stephen A., anything stand out to you more than anything else that he said?
Yeah, there was a lot of quotes of just reiterating the plan and that they might have small tweaks. But Kev, at the end of the interview, he had this line that I had to share with you. He said, we will give the three-year sunset, okay? The three-year sunset will give us time for additional study to see whether there are other creative ways to better distribute talent. Kevin. Oh, wait, a radical idea that in 3 years we might consider other creative ways to distribute talent. Now, Kev, you could read that as maybe that's the wheel,
or an adjusted wheel, a tweaked wheel that Mike Zarin proposed, and that you've been behind, is the idea of like having a 30-year or a long-term set pick distribution, pick slot distribution that rotates every year, that isn't a lottery, that there's certainty there, and you can kind of look at, all right, in 5 years, we'll have the number two pick. Let's gear our entire franchise on the known draft slot we're going to have down the line. That's one thing. Or is that creative other way to distribute talent just going through a free agency model? I don't know, but Adam Silver, even before he's implemented the 3-2-1, is saying, hey, look, in 3 years, we could be potentially blowing this whole system up for a more creative way to distribute talent. I'm just saying.
Well, Adam has always called himself an incrementalist. It's, he himself has said that word, and this would fit that vibe, right? We're going to do this for 3 years, and then we'll take another step forward to something even more extreme. So that's very possible. Tom, I love the fact you use this opportunity for a weekly segment. Let's have a free agent draft. That's what we're going to do. Abolish the draft in Chicago. It is combine week two, Tom. You get all the draft prospects out there, teams interviewing players, players working out. We're seeing new measurements and everything like that. Look, it's I feel like in some ways, the draft process is just beginning in some regards. These interviews are very important. Probably the most important thing for teams this week is getting these to know these guys and talking to them one-on-one, even more so than how a guy does the lane agility drill or if his wingspan is 7 foot instead of 7'1". Anything on your mind from this week in Chicago?
Yeah, I think it was really funny how Cam Boozer's like closest comp in terms of his measurables is his father, Carlos Boozer. and people are like worked up that he didn't have a high vert. And AJ DeBonta had the highest max vert there. Correct me if I'm wrong, right? Like AJ had the highest vert of all the combine numbers.
I'll be honest, the vertical numbers, I mean, you can kind of like fudge those a little bit with whatever your reach is. So the NBA people that I trust are like, that's not the most important thing. And I feel the same way.
I just feel like in today's NBA, vert matters so much less. And how you effectively use your size and speed and breaks is way more important. What I'm trying to say is DeBonta had incredible measurables on that front, but I wouldn't say that like Luka Doncic or James Harden, Jokic can't jump over a phone book. I would not put too much. We're past the point of looking at that and saying that equals athleticism. So there's that. I'll also like, without getting too over our skis on some of these measurables or interviews or shooting drills, is there any big winner that you see in the past few days here that improved their draft stock more than anybody else?
Cameron Carr out of Baylor, without a doubt. Cameron Carr measured at 7'1 wingspan, 6'5 height. And then in the first scrimmage, he scored 30 points and he was draining threes off of movement, 6 of 12 from three. He got inside the paint as well. He had 7 rebounds. He just looked enormous defensively. And this is the guy who wavered between late lottery range, early 20s range. Like when I posted yesterday on X, I said, he's the big riser of the pre-draft process. There's Pistons fans responding like, I was hoping we'd get him at 21. I don't think he's going 21. I think Cameron Carr has done enough with these measurables, 7'1 wingspan. He gained around 10 pounds of muscle, 6'5". He is a 3-and-D guy who can also do some stuff off the dribble as well. He was a shot creator at Baylor. The dude, to me, I wouldn't rule out top 10. I don't think that can be ruled out at all. And I remember way back in November, I had James Barlow, the excellent draft analyst on my podcast at NBA Big Board. And James said to me, I asked him, who's the big riser of the early college basketball season? And the first name he said was Cameron Carr. And combine week, who's the first big riser? It's Cameron Carr again. And I think it's been a big year for him. And the pre-draft process seems to be very big for him as well. Lottery feels safe. I have him ranked 14th right now on my NBA consensus board. But I'm not going to be shocked if he gets taken ahead of some of these smaller guards you often see mocked in the middle of the lottery. So don't rule out Cameron Carr. Like Dallas at 9, oh my God, that would be perfect next to Cooper Flagg and Kyrie Irving and what they're building there. So look, we got a long way to go still, Tom. I mean, we got more scrimmages today at the Combine in Chicago. We'll see who plays, who doesn't, who sits out, who might have gotten a promise, or who just decided to go back to college. A lot more to go, and we'll recap it on my Monday or Tuesday show next week. But yeah, I'm lots of, was just getting started. Still just getting started with the draft.
I think seeing Ade Mara with a 9'9" standing reach, which is only second highest, and only Taco Fall had a higher standing reach. I think he has potential to be the top five guy in this class. And I know that sounds crazy, but when you have a big who can pass and have that kind of feel for the game that he has and that size, I just have a sense that it's kind of what Donovan Klingon reminded me is people looked at the 7'3" and, is he going to be able to endure the NBA game and run up and down? And I just feel like when you have that kind of size and touch and feel and passing, like you say, he's a dime dropper. The assist rate for this guy at that size and wingspan, it's not Rudy Gobert. It's not that at all. And I think that prototype is my favorite player in the NBA. Is a guy with size who can pass the ball like a guard. I think he has potential. I'm not so sure he's going to go number five, but I could see a team taking a big swing with him and end up looking really smart on draft day.
I wouldn't be surprised at all. Not one bit. I think, you know, like I talked with on Chad Ford on my episode on Monday, the Clippers are a team at number five. Throughout the week, I have increasingly heard that the Clippers are a team to watch and trade down possibilities or to surprise some people at that choice. So I think the top four in general, and then, you know, after five, there's going to be surprises for sure. Definitely after the top four. But even within the top four, I mean, it's not a lock that AJ goes number one. Like believe the Wizards when they say to you, like Michael Winger has done like 8 podcasts this week. Believe him when he says, we're looking at 3 or 4 guys for the number one pick. And we're going to evaluate this because it's true. And that's true for number two with Utah. It's true for number three with Memphis. It's true for number four with Chicago. There is no guarantee that it's going to be DiBonsa, Peterson, Boozer, Wilson, like everybody assumes it's going to be. Things could change because all four of those prospects are high-level players. And these teams are going to evaluate what they want to do. They're going to probably haggle with each other as well. Maybe Utah will decide to move up for number one. Might not be for DiBonsa. It could be for DiBonsa. There's just a lot that's going to shake out over this next month and change before we get to the draft in late June. And I'm excited, Tom. I mean, I think the way the order broke down with the Wizards at 1, Jazz at 2, Grizzlies at 3, Bulls at 4, it's fascinating from a team objective perspective, a team need perspective. The fact Utah's number two when they likely wanted AJ DiBonsa and AJ DiBonsa likely wanted them. It's going to make this whole phase very, very exciting to talk about throughout the NBA finals next month during June. It's going to be a lot of draft coverage that month. I'm very excited about it. Tom, thanks for joining me today, man. Any plans this weekend? Anything going on? What you up to?
Yeah, there's going to be a story coming out about Victor Wembanyama and the block Ooh. Record that he set last week. So be on the lookout for that. And the Wilt Chamberlain stats that are coming out now on Basketball Reference, a really cool story. I had a lot of fun writing. So go check that out. And yeah, just a lot of dance recitals and performances, school performances this weekend with the kids. So very excited about that, but mostly, I'm ready for OKC and San Antonio to start. That's what I'm ready for.
I know. I'm ready for it, Tom. I'm ready for one game a night. That's what, like, the conference finals are into the NBA finals are the best. One game a night, you're able just to lock in and focus, and the stakes are so high, and the basketball is such at a high level. Next week can't come soon enough. All right. Thanks, Tom Haverstraw, for joining me today. Thank you, Emmy, for producing today's episode. Thanks to you for giving us a listen. We'll be back on Monday talking about whatever happens this weekend in the NBA. I can't wait. 2 game 6s on Friday, maybe a game seven, probably not, but maybe a game seven on Sunday. We'll definitely be talking about the draft either on Monday or Tuesday or both episodes as well. Hope you all have a good weekend. Enjoy the good weather. Hopefully you're able to enjoy some good weather this weekend. I know I will be out here in New England. Have a good one, everybody. Talk to you later.